Welcome to Get Cozy with Fran. That's me, by the way. Hi. Thank you for joining me today. I hope you're safe and well wherever you are in the world. Today, I'm going to be reading to you from public domain. Birds and Man, it's called. And it's kind of like a memoir, but it explains a little bit about daws, like jackdaws, in the West Country of England. It's really quite lovely because you can picture all of the picturesque, beautiful landscape and the cities, the history. And I really enjoyed reading it as much as I enjoyed narrating it for you. You can actually listen to this whether you want to try and sleep or if you just want to relax and listen to something that doesn't require your full attention while you do something else. You'll have to let me know what you thought of this episode. You can post on my Ko-fi page or on Instagram. I've popped links in the description. Speaking of Ko-fi, if you enjoy my work and it helps you and you want me to continue to make these episodes and reach more people like you, then please consider supporting my work. I've created a membership called Cozy Crew, which you can join. It's a monthly membership, and it gives you full access to the store of MP3s on Ko-fi for free. If you're not a member, you can also download these and pay what you want. I really, really appreciate your support. If you're not able to support financially, then please, if you can, review this podcast on your favourite podcast app or simply share with a friend. My aim is to help you relax and give you a little bit of peace. Thank you again so much. So, let's begin. If you haven't already, make sure you get comfy, that you've had enough to drink, and that you're at a comfortable temperature. As we read Birds and Man by W.H. Hudson. Daws, D-A-W-S, by the way, are more abundant in the west and southwest of England, generally, than in any other part of the kingdom, and they abound most in Somerset, or so it has seemed to me. It is true that the largest congregations of daws in the entire country are to be seen at Savernake in Wiltshire, where the ancient hollow beeches and oaks in the central part of the forest supply them with all the nesting holes they require. There is no such wood of old decaying trees in Somerset to attract them to one spot in such numbers, but the country generally is singularly favourable to them. It is mainly a pastoral country with large areas of rich low grassland and ranges of high hills where there are many rocky precipices such as the daw loves. For very good reasons, he prefers the inland to the sea cliff as a breeding site. It is, to begin with, in the midst of his feeding ground, whereas the sea wall is a boundary to a feeding ground beyond which the bird cannot go. Better still, the inland bird has an immense advantage over the other in travelling to and from his nest in bad weather. When the wind blows strong from the seaside bird must perpetually fight against it and win his home by sheer muscular exertion. The other bird, able to go foraging to this side or that, according to the way the wind blows, can always have the wind as a help instead of a hindrance. Somerset also possesses a long coastline and some miles of sea cliffs, but the colonies of jackdaws found here are small compared with those of the Mendip range. The inland cliff-breeding daws that inhabit the valley of the Somerset Axe alone probably greatly outnumber all the daws in Middlesex, or Surrey or Essex. Finally, besides the cliffs and woods, there are the old towns and villages. Small towns and villages with churches that are almost like cathedrals. No county in England is richer in noble churches, and no kind of building seems more attractive to the ecclesiastical door than the great perpendicular tower of Glastonbury type, which is so common here. Of the old towns which the bird loves and inhabits in numbers, Wells comes first. If Wells had no birds, it would still be a city one could not but delight in. There are not more than half a dozen towns in all the country where, if I were compelled to live in towns, life would not seem something of a burden. And of these, two are in Somerset, Bath and Wells. Of the former, something will be said further on. Wells has the first place in my affections, and is the one town in England, the sight of which in April and early May, from a neighbouring hill, has caused me to sigh with pleasure. Its cathedral is assuredly the loveliest work of man in this land, supremely beautiful. Even without the multitude of doors that make it their house, and may be seen every day in scores, looking like black doves perched on the stony heads and hands and shoulders of that great company of angels and saints, apostles, kings, queens and bishops, that decorate the wonderful West Front. For in this building, not viewed as in a photograph or picture, nor through the eye of the mere architect or archaeologist who sees the gem but not the setting, nature and man appear to have worked together more harmoniously than in others. But it is hard to imagine a birdless Wells. The hills, beautiful with trees and grass and flowers, come down to it. Cattle graze on their slopes. The peewit has its nest in their stony places, and the kestrel, with quick beating wings, hangs motionless overhead. Nature is round it, breathing upon and touching it caressingly on every side, flowing through it like the waters that gave it its name in olden days, that still gush with noise and foam from the everlasting rock, to send their crystal currents along the streets. And with nature, in and around the rustic village-like city, live the birds. The green woodpecker laughs aloud from the group of old cedars and pines, heard by the cathedral close. You will not hear that woodland sound in any other city in the kingdom. And the rooks caw all day from the rookery in the old elms that grow at the side of the palace moat. But the cathedral doors, on account of their numbers, are the most important of the feathered inhabitants of Wells. These city birds are familiarly called bishop's jacks, to distinguish them from the ebor jacks, the doors that in large numbers have their home and breeding place in the neighbouring cliffs called the Ebor Rocks. The Ebor Doors are but the first of a succession of colonies extending along the side of the Cheddar Valley. A curious belief exists among the people of Wells and the district that the Ebor Jacks make better pets than the Bishop's Jacks. If you want a young bird, you have to pay more for one from the rocks than from the cathedral. I was assured that the cliff bird makes a livelier, more intelligent and amusing pet than the other. A similar notion exists, or existed, at Hastings, where there was a saying among the fisher folks and other natives that a Granger dar is worth a halfpenny more than a castle dar. And it's written like D-double-A-da, to sound like a West Country accent. The Granger Rock, once a favourite breeding place of the Doors at that point, has long since fallen into the sea, and the saying has perhaps died out. At Wells, most of the cathedral birds, 100 couples at least, breed in the cavities behind the stone statues, standing, each in its niche, in rows, tier above tier. On the west front, in April, when the daws are busiest at their nest building, I have amused myself early every morning watching them flying to the front in a constant procession, every bird bringing his stick. This work is all done in the early morning, and about 8:30, a man comes with a barrow to gather up the fallen sticks. There is always a big barrowful, heaped high, of them, and if not thus removed, the accumulated material would in a few days form a rampart which would prevent access to the cathedral on that side. It has often been observed that the daw, albeit so clever a bird, shows a curious deficiency of judgment when building, in his persistent efforts to carry in sticks too big for the cavity. Here, for instance, each morning in turning over the litter of fallen material, I picked up sticks measuring from 4 or 5 to 7 feet in length. These very long sticks were so slender and dry that the bird was able to lift and to fly with them. Therefore, to his corvine mind, they were suitable for his purpose. It comes to this. The daw knows a stick when he sees one, but the only way of testing its usefulness to him is to pick it up in his beak, then to try to fly with it. If the stick is 6 feet long and the cavity will only admit one of not more than 18 inches, he discovers his mistake only on getting home. The question arises, does he continue all his life long repeating this blunder? One can hardly believe that an old, experienced bird can go on from day to day and year to year, wasting his energies in gathering and carrying building materials that will have to be thrown away in the end. That he is, in fact, mentally on a level with the great mass of meaner beings who forget nothing and learn nothing. It is not to be doubted that the daw was once a builder in trees, like all his relations, with exception of the cliff-breeding chough. He is even capable of reverting to the original habit. As I know from an instance which has quite recently come to my knowledge. In this case, a small colony of daws had been noticed for several years past breeding in stick nests placed among the clustering foliage of a group of Scotch firs. The colony may have sprung from a bird hatched and reared in the nest of a carrion crow or magpie. Still, the habit of breeding in holes must be very ancient, and considering that the jackdaw is one of the most intelligent of our birds, one cannot be but astonished at the rude, primitive, blundering way in which the nest-building work is generally performed. The most we can see by carefully watching a number of birds at work is that there appears to be some difference with regard to intelligence between bird and bird. Some individuals blunder less than others. It is possible that these have learned something from experience. But if that be so, their better way is theirs only, and their young will not inherit it. One morning at Wells, as I stood on the cathedral green watching the birds at their work, I witnessed a rare and curious scene, one amazing to an ornithologist. A bird dropped a stick. An incident that occurred a dozen times or oftener any minute at that busy time. But in this instance, the bird had no sooner let the stick fall than he rushed down after it to attempt its recovery, just as one may see a sparrow drop a feather or a straw, and then dart down after it and often recover it before it touches the ground. The heavy stick fell straight and fast onto the pile of sticks already lying on the pavement, and instantly the daw was down and had it in his beak, and thereupon laboriously flew up to his nesting place, which was 40 to 50 feet high. At the moment that he rushed down after the falling stick, two other daws that happened to be standing on ledges above dropped down after him and copied his action by each picking up a stick and flying with it to their nests. Other daws followed suit, and in a few minutes there was a stream of descending and ascending daws at that spot, every ascending bird with a stick in his beak. It was curious to see that, although sticks were lying in hundreds on the pavement along the entire breadth of the west front, the daws continued coming down only at that spot where the first bird had picked up the stick he had dropped. By and by, to my regret, the birds suddenly took alarm at something and rose up, and from that moment not one descended. Presently the man came round with his rake and broom and barrow to tidy up the place. Before beginning his work, he solemnly made the following remark: "It is not curious, sir, considering the distance the birds go to get their sticks, and the work of carrying them, that they never, by any chance, think to come down and pick what they have dropped." I replied I had heard the same thing said before, and that it was in all the books, and then I told him of the scene I had just witnessed. He was very much surprised and said that such a thing had never been witnessed before at that place. It had a disturbing effect on him, and he appeared to me to resent the departure from their old, ancient, conservative ways on the part of the cathedral birds. For many mornings after, I continued to watch the daws until the nest building was finished, without witnessing any fresh outbreak of intelligence in the colony. They had once more shaken down into the old, inconvenient, traditional groove, to the manifest relief of the man with the broom and barrow. Bath, like Wells, is a city that has a considerable amount of nature in its composition, and is set down in a country of hills, woods, rocks and streams, and is therefore, like the other, a city loved by daws and many other wild birds. It is a town built of white stone in the hollow of an oblong basin, with the River Avon flowing through it, and though perhaps too large for perfect beauty, it is exceedingly pleasant. Its stone walls do not a prison make, since they do not shut you out from rural sights and sounds. Walking in almost any street, even in the lowest part, in the busiest, noisiest centre of the town, you have but to lift your eyes to see a green hill not far away, and viewed from the top of one of these hills that encircle it. Bath, in certain favourable states of the atmosphere, wears a beautiful look. One afternoon, a couple of miles out, I was on the top of Barrow Hill in a sudden, violent storm of rain and wind. When the rain ceased, the sun burst out behind me, and the town, rain-wet and sun-flushed, shone white as a city built of whitest marble against the green hills and black cloud on the farther side. Then on the slaty blackness appeared a complete and most brilliant rainbow, on one side streaming athwart the green hill and resting on the centre of the town, so that the high, old, richly decorated Abbey Church was seen through a band of green and violet mist. Athwart, by the way, means from side to side or across from. And yes, I did have to Google it. That storm and that rainbow, seen by chance, gave a peculiar grace and glory to Bath, and the bright, unfading picture it left in memory has perhaps become too much associated in my mind with the thought of Bath and has given me an exaggerated idea of its charm. When staying in Bath in the winter of 1898 to 1899, I saw a good deal of bird life even in the heart of the town. At the back of the house I lodged in New King Street, within 4 minutes' walk of the pump room, there was a strip of ground called a garden, but with no plants except a few dead stalks and stumps and two small leafless trees. Clotheslines were hung there, and the ground was littered with old bricks and rubbish, and at the far end of the strip there was a fowl house with fowls in it, a small shed, and a woodpile. Yet to this unpromising-looking spot came a considerable variety of birds. Starlings, sparrows, and chaffinches were the most numerous, while the blackbird, thrush, robin, hedge sparrow, and wren were each represented by a pair. The wrens lived in the woodpile and were the only members of the little feathered community that did not join the others at table when crumbs and scraps were thrown out. It was surprising to find all or most of these birds evidently wintering on that small plot of ground in the middle of the town, solely for the sake of the warmth and shelter it afforded them, and the chance crumbs that came in their way. It is true that I fed them regularly, but they were all there before I came. Yet it was not an absolute safe place for them, being much infested by cats, especially by a big black one who was always on the prowl, and who had a particularly murderous gleam in his luminous yellow orbs when he crouched down to watch or attempted to stalk them. One could not but imagine that the very sight of such eyes in that devilish face would have been enough to freeze their blood with sudden terror and make them powerless to fly from him. But it was not so. He can neither fascinate nor take them by surprise. No sooner would he begin to practice his wiles than all the population would be up in arms, the loud, sharp summons of the blackbird sounding first. Then the starlings would chatter angrily, the thrush scream, the chaffinches begin to pink with all their might, and the others would join in, even the small hideling wrens coming out of their fortress to take part in the demonstration. Then Puss would give it up and go away, or coil himself up and go to sleep on the sloping roof of the tiny shed, or in some other sheltered spot. Peace and quiet would once more settle on the little republic, and the birds would be content to dwell with their enemy in their midst in full sight of them, so long as he slept or did not watch them too narrowly. Finding that blue tits were among the visitors at the back, I hung up some lumps of suet and a coconut to the twigs of the bushes. It's interesting, by the way, to see that coconut is written like cocoa nut, like cocoa as in what you would have in a mug with marshmallows. The suet was immediately attacked, but judging from the suspicious way in which they regarded the round brown object swinging in the wind, the Bath tits had never before been treated to a coconut. But though suspicious, it was plain that the singular object greatly excited their curiosity. Which is really interesting, by the way, isn't it? Because I've bought coconuts filled with suet and fruit and nuts and things, and I've even made them, and it just seems so natural and quite normal now. And I love the idea that once it was very exotic for the little Bath blue tits. On the second day, they made the discovery that it was a new and delightful dish invented for the benefit of the blue tits. And from that time, they were at it at all hours, coming and going from morning till night. There were six of them, and occasionally They were all there at once, each one anxious to secure a place, and never able, when he got one, to keep it longer than 3 or 4 seconds at a time. Looking upon them from an upper window, as they perched against and flitted round and round the suspended coconut, they looked like a gathering of very large, pale blue flies flitting round and feeding on medlar. And I had to Google medlar because I've never heard of it before. And it's a little fruit on a bush that's in the rose family, but they were more popular during medieval times and they're quite rare now. Really interesting. No doubt the sparrow is the most abundant species in Bath. I have got into a habit of not noticing that bird, and it is as if I did not see him. But after him, the starling is undoubtedly the most numerous. He is, we know, increasing everywhere, but in no other town in England have I found him in such numbers. He is seen in flocks of a dozen to half a hundred, busily searching for grubs on every lawn and green place in and round the town. And if you go up to some elevated spot so as to look down upon Bath, you will see flocks of starlings arriving and departing at all points. As you walk the streets, their metallic clink, clink, clink sounds from all quarters, small noises which to most people are lost among the louder noises of a populous town. It is as if every house had a peal of minute bells hidden beneath the tiles or slates of the roof, or among the chimney pots, that they were constantly being rung and that every bell was cracked. The ordinary or unobservant person sees and hears far more of the jackdaw than of any other bird in Bath. Daws are seen and heard all over the town, but are most common about the Abbey, where they soar and gamble and quarrel all day long, and when they think that nobody is looking, drop down to the streets to snatch up and carry off any eatable-looking object that catches their eye.